We have a couple of other announcements that need to be made. The Marriage Enrichment Seminar, June 10 and 11, is being sponsored by this congregation. And it's hoped that all of you and all of us, I'm planning to go, and my wife, Louine, all of us who have a marriage that we feel like is successful, but we want to improve it, or if we are in trouble in our marriages and we need a new shot, an injection to stimulate a healthy marriage, please don't let this pass by. We're planning for about 600 to 800 people to attend, and we're supporting it and sponsoring it, and people from all over the community are going to be attending it. We have on the table here some pre-enrollment blanks. Please enroll, get one of these, enroll for you and your wife. And if you cannot afford to go, please tell the elders, and they will see to it that you are awarded some kind of a scholarship. I think they're making preparations even for that. So if you want to go, be sure to get one of these enrollment blanks. And if you need some financial assistance to go, please see the office or one of the elders. This is a late moment bulletin. The Academy has pulled out into the lead of the collection for food for Marlton Home. I counted today, and we find that the Academy is in the lead with 65 units of cornmeal. The freshmen have pulled way on up out of the cellar, I think, and are now in second place with 63 units of flour. The seniors are down into third place with 62 units of shortening, but that's a very close three-way lead there. And then the sophomores with 52 units of sugar. And the senior saints in the stretch have, they're beginning to falter and gasp for breath, and they've slipped down to fifth place with 45 units of tissue, and then the juniors are, they also ran with 29. So, but it's not too late. The truck doesn't come until tomorrow afternoon, and if you have not gotten your particular item in, please do that, and let's make this one of the best collections we've ever had for the Marlton Home. As a supplement or companion topic of last Sunday night on how to kill a college, I thought I'd speak tonight on how to kill a preacher. And the way to do it is let him speak on how to kill a college without realizing the particular situation that exists on the occasion of his speaking on it. Let those that hear understand. All right, now turn in your Bibles to John, the 20th chapter, verses 30 and 31. We're going to use this as a text tonight, or use it mainly as a springboard. You know, for the last year, we've been working in and out of John's gospel. We've been noticing his magnificent life. We've been noticing some of his miracles. We've noticed his teachings. We noticed in John 6 the climax, or rather the watershed, as it's called, the crisis in his life where his public ministry began to deteriorate and his popularity began to decline. We've noticed so many things in the book of John, and now tonight I want to tie it all together and bring it to a focus so that you can get a handle on it as you would attempt to come to faith yourself, and also to attempt to bring other people to faith. And as we go out of here now, many of us will be leaving. Those of you who are students will be leaving. You'll be leaving us behind, but we're going to be doing the same kind of work that you'll be doing when you leave to go into these other communities. We all need a handle on the gospel of Christ in order to be able to communicate it to other people. And John gives us that handle. In the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 9th and 11th and 20th chapters of the book of John, you have the miracles that John refers to in this text. Let's read John 20, 30, and 31. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. May God bless this reading of his word. The miracles are these. In John, the 2nd chapter, Jesus turned water into wine. In John, the 4th chapter, he healed a nobleman's son. Chapter 5, he healed a man who was a lame man, and healed him there in one of the porches of the pool of Bethesda or Siloam, one of the two, the pool there. In chapter 6, we find him feeding 5,000 people with just a few small fish and loaves of bread. Chapter 6 also, we find the unusual phenomenon of him walking on the water as he came from the feeding place and was preparing to pass his disciples, and they were afraid, and he got into the boat with them. Chapter 9 reveals there the healing of the man that was born blind. Chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Chapter 20, a different kind of miracle in the sense that Jesus did not himself perform it. It was performed upon him by his Father as he was raised from the dead out of the grave into the realm of eternal living people. Now these seven miracles plus the resurrection are all contained in John's gospel. These, John says, were written that you might believe. Now that's the purpose of his including these in the gospel. He asks that you consider these miracles in the context of the whole book, and he says the reason why I have included them is that you might come to faith in Jesus Christ. But the question that we're forced to ask tonight is how? How do these miracles bring us to faith in Jesus Christ? And that's necessary to ask because we're confronted with a different kind of evidence here than that which produces faith in and of itself. Notice, if you will, there are two kinds of evidence mentioned in John the 20th chapter, verses 30 and 31. Those two kinds of evidence are primary evidence and secondary evidence. In the verse 30, we find a reference to primary evidence. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples. Now, those signs that were done in the presence of the disciples constitute primary evidence to the disciples, because that's what that is the definition of primary evidence. It is that which is seen with the eye. It is eye-witnessed by those who were in that presence of Jesus as he performed those miracles. That's primary evidence. And then there's a second reference in verse 31 to secondary evidence. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. He refers here to another kind of evidence, the kind of evidence that is written down in a book, or the kind of evidence that is reported and heard. Either way, it still means that this kind of evidence is secondary evidence. Whenever Jesus was in the presence of these men and did these things, and they saw them being done with their eyes, they saw it, that was primary evidence. And it has a quality all its own. And then, however, whenever miracles or signs of that nature, whenever they move out of that realm and are brought over into the realm that simply are told about, or they are read out of a book, those are not primary evidence. And today, you and I do not have any primary evidence of the miracles of Jesus Christ. The only evidence that we have today is secondary. And we've got to recognize this. It's a vital factor in not only your coming to faith, but it's a vital factor in your bringing anyone else to faith. You've got to reckon with the fact that there are two kinds of evidence. Primary evidence is that which is seen with the eye. Secondary evidence is that which only is heard with the ear, the report of it, or the record of it is seen with the eye. That's secondary evidence. Now let me give you an example of both of these in this very chapter. If you have your Bibles, I want you to turn to your 20th chapter and look back at verse 19. Do you remember the night after the resurrection of Jesus on Lord's Day morning? That night, Jesus appeared to the 10 disciples. Judas had killed himself, and Thomas was not with them. But there were 10 of these disciples in the upper room, and it says that the door was shut for fear of the Jews, implying that the door was locked. And so these 10 men were behind these locked doors, and they were discussing some of the reports that had come in from other people, how that other people had seen the Lord. And then, in the midst of these men, Jesus himself stands and appears. He materializes and forces these men, through the sheer pressure of this evidence that is forced upon them, to acknowledge that he indeed has been raised and is standing there in their very presence. And he says, I am not a spirit. Feel of me. A spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see me having. And so these men came to faith in Jesus Christ at that point that he was actually raised from the dead. Second scene. These men then go to Thomas. And with this primary evidence that they have seen, they then report this evidence to Thomas, But when in the process of their reporting it, it ceases to be primary evidence. It becomes secondary evidence to Thomas because he wasn't there with them to see it with his own eyes. He merely heard them tell about it. And what happened when he heard them tell about it was, he just simply says, I don't believe it. Furthermore, I won't believe it unless I can have the same kind of evidence that you've had. Unless I can feel the finger, put my finger into his nail prints and put my hand into his side, I won't believe it. All right? Scene 3. The next Sunday night, Thomas was with the other 10 in the upper room, the doors being closed, and Jesus again materialized in their presence and gives Thomas more evidence. As an apostle of the Lord, he not only merited and had the right to expect Jesus to give him eyewitness evidence, but Jesus also complied with that and brought Thomas this additional evidence so that Thomas himself would also have this eyewitness, primary, firsthand evidence. And Jesus called for Thomas right off the bat. He said, Thomas, come here and put your hand in my nail prints and put your hand in my side and don't be disbelieving, Thomas. You believe. And then Thomas cried out upon the basis of this primary evidence, my Lord and my God. And then Jesus acknowledges both kinds of evidence and both kinds of believers. The kind of believer who was there and saw it with his eye and the kind of evidence that was seen with the eye. And then those who are not there to see it with their eye, but merely read about it in a book or hear the report of it with the ear. He refers to both kinds of listeners or both kinds of believers and both kinds of evidence. Listen, in verse 29 of that 20th chapter, after Thomas had said, my Lord and my God, then Jesus said to him, have you believed because you've seen me? What kind of evidence is that? It's primary evidence. He said, Thomas, have you believed me because you've received this primary evidence? And the answer was yes. Then Jesus made the statement, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. And consequently then he recognizes, he acknowledges, he endorses both kinds of evidence. And he distinguishes between the two and says that actually there's a greater blessing in believing not having seen him with the eye than it was believing having seen him with the eye. And I take it that the difference in the degree of blessedness was dependent upon the degree of difficulty that comes with the two kinds of evidence. Whenever you talk about eyewitness evidence and firsthand evidence, what is the nature of firsthand evidence with people? What's the nature of it? What does it tend to do? Does it tend to push you into faith or into doubt, this firsthand evidence, primary evidence? Do you know? Bill, what does it do? Primary evidence that you see with your own eyes, does it tend to push you into faith or into doubt? Who knows? It tends to push you into faith. What happens when you say something that's incredible to somebody, you know, and they say, are you sure? You say, I saw it with my own eyes. I know what I'm talking about. And the first thing that you say as evidence or as proof that you saw something or that it existed, you say, I saw it with my own eyes. Whereas the nature of secondary evidence is just the opposite. The nature of secondary evidence in and of itself does not tend to push a person into faith. It tends to push him into doubt. Now, do you doubt that? Then look at the example that John himself gives of Thomas. Thomas received secondary evidence at first. The others received the primary evidence. They believed. And when they reported it then and it became secondary evidence to Thomas only, Thomas says, I won't believe, not unless I see him myself. I've got to have that primary, first-hand eyewitness evidence. And consequently, you have these two different kinds of evidence. But may I say tonight that you and I don't have that choice. The only evidence that we have tonight is that which John and other men recorded in the Gospels regarding the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. All we've got is secondary evidence, and we've got to reckon with it as secondary evidence. Well, how then does secondary evidence serve us tonight? How do these records of the miracles of Jesus, how do they serve us tonight as we struggle to come to faith and as we struggle to bring other people to faith? How does secondary evidence serve us? It can serve us really in a positive, constructive way only as it is used as one of the component parts of what I'm going to call self-substantiating evidence. Now, I know that's a big mouthful, but it's very simple. It's very practical. I'm not going to get technical with you tonight. I'm going to be so practical that you're not going to be able to misunderstand it. But it serves us in a practical way, this secondary evidence does, these records of the miracles. They serve us in a constructive way only if they are used as one of the component parts of what we'll refer to as self-substantiating evidence. And we're going to use it in that way tonight. Now, let me give you an illustration. Let me explain it first of all. What is self-substantiating evidence? You say, well, you're way out. I don't anymore know what you're talking about. Yes, you do. What is self-substantiating evidence? You brought with you two examples of self-substantiating mechanical devices with you tonight. You know what a self-substantiating mechanical device is? Well, did you bring two hands? This is a self-substantiating mechanical device. A thumb opposing four fingers is a self-substantiating mechanical device. It can pick up a Bible. It can pick up a clock because you put it between your thumb and your fingers. That's self-substantiating mechanical device. I'm talking with a self-substantiating mechanical device. My jaw, you've got one. You brought it with you. You ate supper tonight. Did you ever try to eat with just one jaw? Be pretty difficult, wouldn't it? Why? Well, because God made it so you could get that piece of meat between two jaws and bear down on it and get some action involved. Well, it's a self-substantiating mechanical device. If you bought a pair of fingernail clippers with you tonight, if you've brought them with you, you've got a self-substantiating mechanical device. It has two jaws and it self-substantiates itself within the same mechanism. Now, what you see behind me, those of you who don't appreciate art won't recognize it. That's a vise. It's a vise. It's a mechanical device. It is a self-substantiating device. The blue part there is that's located and locked down on the mechanical thing itself. It doesn't move. Now, those of you who've ever used a vise know what I'm talking about. It's that backdrop. It's always in the same location. The part that's red is that's movable. And then this black thing is the handle, obviously, and it's that turns upon the spindle there, the threads, and you take that thing and you, if you want to put a piece of wood in there, you put it in there in front of that, the blue part, and then you run that red part up on it and it catches it in what I call catches it coming and going. It catches it at the back and catches it at the front, and it's locked together in the same mechanical device. Now that's what I refer to as a self-substantiating mechanical device. That's the kind of evidence that is contained in the Gospels. Thank God we have that kind of evidence in the Gospel of Jesus Christ. We have self-substantiating evidence, that is, evidence that is in the same framework, that is in the same literary framework, and it consists of that backdrop plus the movable part, and we're going to identify them just briefly and just now. The Gospel, though, contains that kind of evidence. For example, the first one of these that I want to refer to is that's illustrated by the blue immovable part. That is that undeniably beautiful part of the life of Jesus Christ that everybody that has any desire at all to serve God recognizes as true and undeniable. And we're going to refer to those things tonight briefly as the undeniables. Those undeniables are Jesus' association with people, his teachings, his conversations, the association that he had, say, with the woman at the well, that he had with Nicodemus as he talked with him and spoke to him the truths of God, the one that he had with the woman taken in adultery there in John 8, all of those things throughout John's gospel that just simply, when you present them to people, all of a sudden they begin thinking, you know, whether they're aware of it or not, oh, that's so beautiful. Man, there's something about that man's life, and they may not admit it to you, you know, they may play it real cool, but all of a sudden, that emptiness way deep down inside them has begun to be filled. And they begin to sense, oh, tell me that story again. Tell me the one again about the thief on the cross. Or tell me that story again about the woman taken in adultery. Or tell me again about Nicodemus. And on, they want these things about Jesus Christ told them. If you move out of John's gospel and yet stay within the framework of the gospels, you still have the same effect of self-substantiating evidence, and you move into the Beatitudes. You hear him tell people, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. You hear him telling them that a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. You hear him tell people, don't be anxious about what you're going to put on or what you're going to eat. He said, your heavenly Father knows that you have need of these things. Look at the birds of the air. Look at the flowers of the field. And he goes, and we go into these teachings of Jesus Christ that are just so absolutely beautiful and absolutely true. Such things also that can be tested in the test tube of life is this: love your neighbor like you love yourself. He says, if you'll do this, you'll live. Or as you would that men should do to you, you do so to them. This is the law and the prophets. And you can put these things in a test tube of life's experiences, and you can ask anybody else in the world practically to do the same thing. And the great majority of them will come out of there saying, you know what? He's right. You treat your neighbor like you want to be treated, and I guarantee you it'll work. And if you haven't tried it, you ought to try it. And if you want to love your neighbor like you love yourself, try that on your wife and see what happens to your marriage. And on and on and on you could go. And the absolute sheer beauty of the life of Jesus Christ that we're going to refer to as the undeniables, those things are all through the gospel story. You can't read it without grabbing a hold of it. You can't read it without it grabbing a hold of you. And furthermore, you can't study it with somebody who wants to know what God wants of them, who will study the gospels in neutral. You can't study that with them without it grabbing a hold of them. And consequently, you find people saying, whether they know what's happening to them or not, they began to experience the living Word, the balm of Gilead, the rose of Sharon, and all the beauty of His life and the fragrance of that great life began to trickle over into their life and fill those vacancies and fill up the voids that their life has possessed for so long. And they may not know what's happening, but we know what's happening because it's those undeniable things of the life of Jesus Christ that everybody will admit if they're just simply seeking. Jesus said in John 7 and 17, if any man wants to do His will, that is the Father's will, he'll know of my teaching, whether I'm speaking from God or whether I speak on my own authority. Now, Jesus said, in reference to this area that we're calling the blue area, the undeniables, He says, if you'll just examine my teachings, if you really want to know the will of God and do it, you'll know whether my teaching is from myself or whether I'm speaking from God. So I refer to that simply as the undeniable part of the gospel. But then there's another area. And that's the unbelievable part of it. And they're all mixed up together. And John is saying in John 20, 30, and 31, I have included these unbelievable things in the context of the undeniable things so that you can believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that's all he's saying. But he is saying that. As you began to study the life of Christ, you began to study about those things that are undeniable. And man, you come into all those beautiful things that I've already mentioned. You don't get through all of them because, incidentally, as you get into the second chapter, all of a sudden you're abruptly interrupted by this unbelievable thing that he says that was said of him that he did, that he turned water to wine. The unbeliever, he's enthralled by the way Jesus talked to Peter and James and John and those men in chapter 1 of John. He's a very kind fellow, very hospitable. They went home with him that day, and they walk with him through that social hospitality, and they think that's good. But all of a sudden, lo and behold, here he is claiming to have turned water into wine. And the unbeliever says, you know, oh, I don't know whether. You expect me to believe that? Well, you say, no, not really right now. You don't have any reason to believe it right now. Just let's look at it and see what happens, and let's look at the effect that it had upon the people there, and don't worry about making a decision on it right now. We'll come back later. So you get out of the wedding at Cana and you go on into the temple and you let them see Jesus Christ take a whip and drive out the money changers and overturn the tables and cause this havoc in the temple of God. And they just sit there amazed at this man who had the audacity to stand up against the whole of the Jewish religion and the hierarchy of the Jewish nation. And they may very well find themselves saying, go on, get him again, hit him again. And then lo and behold, you get out of chapter 2 and you come into chapter 3 and then on into chapter 4. You see him talking to Nicodemus in chapter 3, and then in chapter 4, you find him sitting there at the well with the woman there talking about water, sending her after her husband, talking about how she'd had 5 husbands, and now the one she had wasn't even her husband, and she tried to change the subject, and he was so gentle and so decisive, though, with her, and then revealed to her that he was the Christ. And then on and on, you get on into the latter part of chapter 4, and you find Jesus healing this nobleman's son. Another one of these abruptive, disruptive reports about this man's power. In fact, the man healed this son of this man, and he wasn't even in the boy's presence. The man came and said, come and heal my son. Jesus said, go your way. He's healed. And you mean to tell me that that boy was healed? Jesus didn't even know where the boy was. He didn't tell you he knew. He knew, evidently. So that's one of the claims that's made. Well, the man that's not a believer says, you know, I don't know whether I can hold. I can't accept that. He didn't even go and touch the boy. I know it. He didn't even ask where the boy's address was. I know it. But that's part of the gospel that John recorded. These things are written that you might believe. Well, you get on out of chapter 4 and go into chapter 5 and you see him heal this man that was lame. And then on into chapter 6 and you find him feeding the 5,000.
And then on in chapter 6, later on, he walked on the water, that phenomenon that's absolutely unbelievable to an unbeliever. He said, I just can't accept that. Well, all right, let's go on. We'll see some more later. So what you do, you keep weaving these things that are the unbelievable things into the context of the undeniable things until you finally bring these people to a real, they don't know what to do. You bring them into a crisis. You bring them into a dilemma. That's what we're hoping to do. And you know what? You'll have to add to the things that Jesus did. You'll have to add to those things that he did, those signs that he did. You'll have to add 75 claims that this man made to divinity. John's gospel contains about 20 days of the life of Jesus. During those 20 days, John records that Jesus claimed either to be God or the Son of God 75 times. Well, how in the world are you going to prove that? I can't prove it. You can't prove it either, any more than you can prove his miracles. Well, how are we going to be brought to faith then? The same way that I've been talking about tonight, through this method of the self-incriminating or self-substantiating is what we'd better call it, self-substantiating evidence that brings the unbelievable things into context with the undeniable things, just like the vice here. Those things that cannot be shaken are the backdrop for those things that can be moved, and in between the two of these, you're forced to either curse him or confess him. You're forced to either hate him or love him, but you can't ignore him. And that's why John is saying, I've written these things, and I have included these very things in the life of Jesus Christ, in the record of his life, so that you will believe that, or so that you may believe that he's the Son of God. You know, the world would really love to have a Christ where these things are deleted out of the record. Boy, if you could just get them to delete those things out of the record. A man told me one time, he said, you know, if it weren't for the miracles of Jesus, I could really believe in that man. I said, sir, you've missed the point. You've missed the whole point. That's the very thing that John says you can't do. You can't accept Jesus as just a good man. If you were to delete all the miracles and the claims of Jesus out of the Gospels, you'd have one of the finest men. Man, he was a social person. He was hospitable. He was kind. He was generous. He was gentle. He was a good teacher. He had a good personality. Everything about him was on the plus side of the ledger. If you could just get him to quit talking about all this thing about being God. And if you could just get all his disciples to quit recording all those things that they said he did that they saw with their own eyes. Why don't they quit talking about it? Because you can't do it. There's too much at stake. This man who was not just superior, this man was suprahuman. This man, he claims for himself, and it was claimed of him, that he was not just man. He was man and God. He was all man and he was all God. He was all God and he was all man. That's exactly what it is claimed for him in the New Testament. Well, that's how this evidence must be used. Now, these two kinds of evidence, that we'll call the undeniable, that's represented by the blue area, that's undeniable, you can't shake it. That's called, we'll call it the unbelievable, that has to be set in the context of that undeniable, or else you've got a predicament like you'd have if you didn't have the backdrop of that vice. What would happen if you tried to screw the front part of a vise if there never was any back part? Well, you'd screw that thing all the way to New York City and it never would come up against anything. You never would get a hold of anything. What would happen if you took all the miracles and the claims of Jesus and did not set them in the context of the greatness of his own life and in the beauty and the superlativeness of it? What would happen? Well, you'd screw that evidence all the way to New York City and all the way to doomsday. You never would get anything that would hold you to where you'd come to faith. Now, let me illustrate it and then give you an example, and we'll close. There was a young boy in 1974, 73 or 4, I forget now which year. His name was not Eric Steinhauer, it was something Steinhauer, but I keep calling him Eric, and we'll just call him Eric tonight. He was from the Scandinavian countries. He came over to America, brought his bicycle with him on the plane, and spent several months bicycling through America on the eastern coast, up and down the seaboard and all. And the boy was an atheist. He had met some campaigners overseas from David Lipscomb College who had influenced him to come over here to America to see it and to bicycle around. And so he had done that. But he was still an atheist. And he told me once in a conversation, as I asked him what about his faith and what did he think about Jesus, he told me what happened to him one night. He said, Mr. Woodruff, as an atheist, I had come to the place that I didn't know any longer what was reality and what was non-reality. He said, I didn't know the difference between an illusion and a fact. He said, as I was riding down the highway one night, and he said, that's what happens to atheists or people who don't believe. You get to the place where you don't know whether that highway is an illusion or actually a concrete reality. You don't know whether you're real. You don't know whether other people are real. You just kind of get off into a fuzzy realm that you don't know really what is right. He said, I had come to that place. He said, I had enough energy and enough sense left to make one decision. And he said, this was it. He said, I decided that I would put the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth to the test and see perhaps if they worked. And he told me, he said, Mr. Woodruff, I put the teachings of Jesus to the test. He said, and I want you to know that every last thing that Jesus taught that I tested proved to be true. Now, that's an atheist talking. He put it to test in the test tube of life. Love your neighbor like you love yourself. He said, I tried it. He said, it works. Do unto others as you'd have them do to you. I tried it. It works. He said, everything that I found that Jesus taught, when I put it to the test, I found out that it works. It works. Well, you know what he had done? He had gotten into that blue area of Jesus' life, the undeniables, and he had put them to test, and he found out you can't move those things. They were true back then. They're true now. They'll be true as long as the earth stands, and when the earth is no longer here, they'll still be true. And he saw them as an atheist. Well, I said, well, all right, Eric, or Mr. Steinhauer, I said, why then are you not a disciple of Jesus? Why have you never been baptized upon this faith? He said, I don't know. Well, I kept poking and probing and trying to get him to say a bit more. And finally, I thought, oh, I asked him a question. I said, Eric, what do you think about the miracles of Jesus? You know what he said? He said, I don't spend much time thinking about his miracles. And I could tell immediately that I'd struck a nerve. He said, I don't spend much time thinking about his miracles. I pressed him. I said, what do you think about this report that he walked on water? And it embarrassed him. He said, I don't spend much time thinking about it. I said, I know exactly where you are then in your faith. I know why you've never submitted to Christ and his Lordship. I said, being baptized is the silliest thing on God's earth if the man that commanded it is not the Son of God himself. And until you've wrestled with the miracles of Jesus Christ that elevate him up beyond just the average and the ordinary, until you've wrestled with that which makes him either God or an absolute liar, you're not ever going to be a disciple of Jesus. I said, you're right at the point where you're going to have to examine the miracles of Jesus if you ever come to faith in him. And he sat there a minute and he said, you know, that's exactly right. That's where I am. I don't know whether the boys ever obeyed the gospel or not, but he saw that he had now established the blue part, the undeniables. He knew. Now he was going to have to examine those things that were the unbelievables and look at them in the context of the undeniables, or else there wouldn't be any coming to faith. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? Is this clear? Let me illustrate it. Say Farmer Brown and his wife come into town. He comes in because she's pulling him. She saw something down at Sears Roebuck, and she wants him to see it. And so she says, come on, John, you promised me, come on. So she takes him down there, and she takes him in there, and there's this huge refrigerator freezer. They've lived out in the country all their lives. All they had was a well or a cistern and a well house, and that's where they kept the milk, you know, and it even clabbered then. But nevertheless, they kept everything there. They had to can everything they kept or smoke the meat, and all this time-consuming activity that occupied them. She saw something, though, that she just couldn't stand. It just literally turned her on. She said, come here, I want you to see this thing. And she comes in, she says to the salesman, show him what you showed me. So the salesman takes him around there and opens the door to the refrigerator, and he says, sir, you see this circulating air around this meat keeper and that, and then around your vegetables, and you see this, you push this button and you get cold water, you push this button, you get ice. And the man sitting there, and sure enough, there begins to come up in this old fellow the same thing that came up in his wife. We've needed this all of our lives. And he said, you haven't seen anything yet. Look at the freezer part. Smoke's all, that's over. You don't have to smoke anymore. You don't have to cure anything else. You can just freeze it. Put those steaks in here in the freezer, and when you want one, go in there and get it, thaw it out, and have it that same day. Well, boy, all of a sudden, he began to see, sure enough, tell me more. And he told him how it's self-defrosting, it's self-everything else, and the whole thing. Man, it's just fantastic. And there began to be this old thing, you know, all these things deep down inside that he knew he needed, he thought, Anyway, down there, he said, man, that's beautiful. I really need that. As they walk around that thing, there's also a price tag on it, $500. And eventually he gets around to it. But what I'm saying to you, the first thing he does, he shows these people the undeniables. Boy, they know it. And they know that they've been wasting time. They'd have time to do a whole lot of things if they could just get that they know really and truly answers all these needs. And then he takes them and shows them the unbelievables, $500. But you know what that salesman doesn't do? Whenever Mrs. Farmer Brown came in and said, show him what you showed me, he doesn't take him over there and point at that tag and say, look at that, $500. You never will pay for this thing. You'll be up working all your life. You know? Why, of course not. He's got more sense than that. He knows that this farmer who works hard for his money and to whom the price of a pig is a lot, he knows good and well that he's not going to accept that $500 unbelievable without seeing it in the context of all these undeniables. But he knows that if he can show him all these undeniables and show him all the value of having this thing and then show him that unbelievable, why, he's going to accept that. And finally, he says it. Now, this thing costs $500. But I think you can see why. You see all these things? That's right. Now, listen, do we have as much sense as that salesman? We've got such a better product than a refrigerator freezer. We've got the Lord Jesus Christ, the very Son of God Himself, to take to the world. How are you going to do it? If you'll use John's gospel, you can see how to do it. He uses it in a framework and shows you how to do it. He talks about this kind of evidence, self-substantiating evidence. How do you go about it? Get to know Jesus Christ so well that you know Him well enough that you can go and sit down with the person and say, look, this is this man's life. Isn't it beautiful? Will you just consider it in neutral gear? Will you look at him with me? And then you begin to weave into those undeniables, those things that are the unbelievables. And there's this tension that begins to be created in the person. He doesn't quite know what to do. Until finally you come to John 20, 30, and 31, and it says, these things, there are many things that Jesus did that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And then you just say to him, what do you think? Now he's going to do one of two things. He will, by that time, have seen such beauty and majesty in the life of Jesus and have seen such truth about his life that he will be forced to accept the miracles as being God's way of intervening in the human history, in the human dilemma, the human problem. He will either see it as God's intervention, or else he'll see it, the whole thing, as man's invention. That he's just a fable, or else if he lived, he was a lunatic, or he was a liar. But I'll guarantee you, you will have communicated Jesus Christ to him, and if you'll just watch and pray and let that germinate or let that seed have time to germinate, you're going to find that man, if he's an honest man or an honest woman, he that wills to do my Father's will know of my teaching, whether I'm speaking on my own authority or whether I'm speaking from God. And consequently, we come to John 20, 30, and 31. These things were written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. I hope you can get a handle on this tonight. I hope you'll wade through it yourself. You've got to come through this crisis point yourself. If you've never accepted Jesus Christ as the Son of God, maybe it's because you've never allowed yourself to be forced to that dilemma, to where you're forced to either conclude that he's a maniac or a liar or a lunatic or a legend, or perhaps he's what he claims to be, Lord. Now listen, if he's Lord whether you accept him or not. And the day's coming, and I pray to God that it'll be soon. He's coming back. I'm going with him, and I want you to go with him. You can, if you believe. Well, I don't know about all those miracles. I know it. Look in his life, and if his life is not of the same character that the miracles are, if this is not the most consistent thing in the world, don't accept it. If his miracles are not anything other than just what he himself was in his own person, don't have anything to do with it. If you read about all these fantastic, fabulous claims to miracles and the 75 claims that he makes to being God, look at him under the microscope, and if you don't catch that same quality in his life, I say dismiss him and go on your way somewhere else. But if you'll put those unbelievable things in the context of the undeniable things, I guarantee you, you're going to be like a man with his hand caught in a vice. You're not going to be able to get away. You're going to be a disciple of the Lord Jesus Christ. And maybe you're already there tonight at that point. If you are, we want to extend the invitation to you tonight to express your faith, to be immersed in water, to be raised to walk a new life. Wouldn't you want to do that? As Brother Benson said this morning, you'll want to become a Christian someday. Why not do it today? It's the easiest time in your life. You may be nearer the kingdom right now than you've ever been. What do you say? Would you come? We're going to sing this song of invitation. We want to assist you if you'll let us. Come while we stand and sing.
Crown him with many crowns, the Lamb upon his throne.